He looked up. Does this have anything to do with the text you sent me this morning, Edward Radcliffe? I'm still trying to figure that out. I wouldn't be surprised. This photo is classic aestheticism. The engaging expression, the loose dress and fluid posture, early to mid-1860s, if I had to guess. It reminded me of the Pre-Raphaelites. Related, definitely, and of course the artists of the time were all inspired by one another. They obsessed over things like nature and truth, colour, composition and the meaning of beauty. But where the Pre-Raphaelites strove for realism and detail, the painters and the photographers of the Magenta Brotherhood were devoted to sensuality and motion. There's something moving about the quality of light, don't you think? The photographer would be thrilled to hear you say so. Light was of principal concern to them. They took their name from Goethe's colour wheel theories, the interplay of light and dark, the idea that there was a hidden colour in the spectrum between red and violet that closed the circle. You have to remember, it was right in the middle of a period when science and art were exploding in all directions. Photographers were able to use technology in ways they hadn't before, to manipulate light and experiment with exposure times to create new effects. She paused while the waitress delivered their coffees. Edward Radcliffe was very well regarded, but not as famous as some of the other members of the Magenta Brotherhood went on to become. Remind me? Thurston Holmes, Felix and Adele Bernard, they all met at the Royal Academy and bonded over their anti-establishment ideas, tight-knit, but with all the lies, lust and split loyalties you'd expect in a cutthroat 19th century art world. Radcliffe was prodigiously talented, but he died young. Pippa returned her attention to the photograph. What makes you think he might have something to do with her? Elodie explained about the archive box and the satchel with Edward Radcliffe's initials on it. There was a document holder inside that belonged to James Stratton. The only thing in it was this framed photo. And Radcliffe was a friend of your main man? I've never come across the connection before, Elodie admitted. That's one of the strange things about it all. She took a sip of her flat white as she decided whether to continue. She was torn between two opposing urges, a desire to tell Pippa everything and draw on her best friend's knowledge of art history, and an odd sensation that had come over her when she'd handed the photograph to Pippa. An almost jealous drive to keep the photo, the sketch, all for herself. It was an inexplicable and not particularly worthy impulse, and so she made herself continue. The photo wasn't the only item inside the satchel. There was a sketchbook. What sort of sketchbook? Leather cover, about so big, she demonstrated with her hands. Page after page of pen and ink sketches, handwritten notes. I think it belonged to Edward Radcliffe. Pippa, who was never surprised by anything, drew breath. She caught herself quickly. Was there anything in it you could use to date the work? I haven't been all the way through, not carefully, but Stratton's document holder was made in 1861. I've no way of knowing if they're related, of course, she reminded Pippa, beyond somehow having wound up in the same satchel over the course of 150 years. What were the drawings like? What were they of? Figures, profiles, landscapes, a house? Why? There were rumours of an abandoned work. After Radcliffe's fiancée's death, he continued to paint, but not with the same spirit as before, and very different subjects. And then he drowned abroad. It was all very tragic. The idea of this abandoned work, something he was working on before her death, has taken on a sort of mythology in art history circles. People keep hoping and guessing and positing theories. Every so often, an academic takes it seriously enough to write a paper, even though to this point there hasn't been a lot of evidence to support the idea. It's one of those whispers that's so tantalising it refuses to die. You think the sketchbook might have something to do with it? Hard to say for sure without seeing it. I don't suppose you've got any more tea-towel surprises in that bag of yours. Elodie's cheeks warmed. I could never take the sketchbook out of the archive. Well, why don't I drop in next week and have a look? Something tightened unpleasantly in Elodie's stomach. You'd better call first. Mr. Pendleton's on the warpath. Pippa flapped her hand, unperturbed. Course. She leaned back in her chair. In the meantime, I'll get started on your dress. I can already picture it. Romantic, gorgeous, very now, in an 1860s sort of way. I've never been particularly fashionable. Hey, nostalgia's very much in vogue, you know. Pippa was being affectionate, but today it rankled. Elodie was a nostalgic person, but she hated the charge. The word was terribly maligned. People used it as a stand-in for sentimentality, when it wasn't that at all. Sentimentality was mawkish and cloying, where nostalgia was acute and aching. It described yearning of the most profound kind, an awareness that time's passage could not be stopped and there was no going back to reclaim a moment or a person or to do things differently. Of course, Pippa had only meant to make a light, humorous comment and had no idea, as she gathered up her scrapbook, that Elodie was thinking along such lines. Why was she so sensitive today? Ever since she'd looked inside the satchel, she'd been unsettled. She felt constantly distracted, as if there was something she was supposed to do that had slipped her mind. Last night, she'd even had the dream again. She'd been at the house in the sketch when suddenly it turned into a church, and she realised that she was late for a wedding, her own. And she started to run, but her legs wouldn't work properly. They kept collapsing as if they were made of string. And when she finally arrived, she found that it was no longer a wedding at all. She was too late. It was now a concert, and her mother, still only 30 years old, was on stage playing her cello. How are the rest of the wedding clans coming along? Fine. They're fine. It had come out crisply, and Pippa noticed. The last thing Elodie wanted was to get mired in a deep and meaningful that might expose her malaise, so she added airily, "Of course, if it's details you're after, you'd best speak with Penelope. I'm told it's going to be beautiful." "Just make sure she remembers to tell you where and when to show up." They smiled at one another, allies again, and then Pippa continued with blistering politeness. "And how is the fiancé?" Pippa and Alistair had got off on the wrong foot, which wasn't entirely surprising as Pippa had strong opinions and a sharp tongue and didn't suffer fools gladly. Not that Alistair was a fool. Elodie winced at her own mental slip of the tongue. Only that he and Pippa weren't at all alike. Regretting her earlier sharpness, Elodie decided to wear some disloyalty to let her friend score a point. "He seems reassured that Mother is calling the shots." Pippa grinned. "And your dad?" "Oh, you know, Dad, he's happy if I'm happy." "And are you?" Elodie gave a firm look. Okay, you're happy." "He's given me the recordings." "He was okay with it then?" "Seemed to be. He didn't say much. I think he agrees with Penelope that it will be like having her there." "Is that how you feel?" Elodie didn't want to be having this discussion. "We have to have some sort of music," she replied defensively. "It makes sense to keep it in the family." Pippa looked as if she were about to say something further, but Elodie got in first. "Did I ever tell you that my parents had a shotgun wedding? They were married in July and I was born in November.
A little stowaway."
"You know how I feel about parties, always looking for somewhere to hide." Pippa smiled.
"You do realise you're going to have to attend this one, that your guests will be expecting to see you."
"Speaking of my guests, do you think you could be a dear and send back your RSVP?
"What? In the post? With a stamp?"
"Apparently it's important. It's a thing."
"Well, if it's a thing."
"It is, and I've been reliably informed that my friends and family are bucking the system. Tip's next on my list."
"Tip? How is he?"
"I'm off to see him tomorrow. Don't suppose you want to come?" Pippa wrinkled her nose in disappointment.
"I have a gallery event. Speaking of which..."
She signalled the waitress to bring the bill and pulled a £10 note from her wallet. While she was waiting, she indicated the framed photograph lying beside Elodie's empty coffee cup.
"I'm going to need a copy so I can start thinking about your dress."
Elodie was seized again by the odd possessive urge.
"I can't lend it to you." "Course not. I'll take a pic now with my phone."
She lifted the frame, angling the picture to make sure her shadow didn't fall across it.
Elodie sat on her hands, willing her friend to finish quickly, and then she rewrapped the photo in its cotton shroud. "You know what?" said Pippa, inspecting the shot on her phone screen. "I'm going to run this by Caroline. She wrote her masters on Julia Margaret Cameron and Adele Bernard. I bet she'll be able to tell us something about the model, perhaps even who it was that took the photo." Caroline was Pippa's mentor from art school, a filmmaker and photographer, renowned for her ability to find moments of beauty where they were least expected. Her images were wild and alluring, with lots of lean trees and houses and wistful landscapes. She was 60 or so, with the lithe movements and energy of a much younger woman. She had no children of her own and seemed to look upon Pippa as a daughter of sorts. Elodie had met her a couple of times socially. She had striking silver hair cut straight and thick across her shoulder blades, and was the sort of woman whose self-possession and authenticity made Elodie feel like a bad fit for her own skin. "No," she said quickly, "don't do that."
"Why not?"
"I just..." There was no way of explaining that the photo had been hers alone and now it wasn't, without sounding petty and, frankly, a bit unhinged. "I just meant there's no need to bother Caroline. She's so busy."
"Are you kidding? She'd love to see it."
Elodie managed a weak smile and told herself that it would be helpful to have Caroline's input. Unpleasant personal feelings aside, it was her job to learn as much as she could about the photograph and the sketchbook. And if a genuine tie to Radcliffe heralded any new information on James Stratton, it would be a very good thing for the archive team at Stratton Cadwell & Co. New information on well-known Victorians did not surface often. Chapter 5. Elodie walked the long way back, detouring down Lamb's Conduit Street because it was pretty, and the dove grey chocolate box of the Persephone shopfront always managed to lift her spirits. She ducked inside, force of habit, and it was there, while she was leafing through the war diaries of Vere Hodgson, soaking up a 1930s swing dance track, that her phone began to shrill. It was Penelope, again, and Elodie suffered an immediate clutch of panic. She left the bookstore, cutting quickly across Theobald's Road and then High Holborn, through to Lincoln's Inn Fields. Elodie picked up her pace as she passed the Royal Courts of Justice, darted behind a red bus to cross the street, and was almost jogging as she made her way along the Strand. Rather than go straight back to work, where Mr. Pendleton was in exactly the sort of mood to relish catching one of them making personal calls, she slipped down a cobbled laneway that dog-legged towards the river and found a bench on Victoria Embankment, right near the pier. She fished out her notebook and flipped to where she'd written the phone number of the wedding reception venue in Gloucestershire. Elodie dialed and made an appointment to visit the following weekend, leaving no time for her commitment to cool. She telephoned Penelope, apologised for having missed her calls, and launched into a report of the progress she'd made with respect to the venue, the veil, the dress, and the videos. After she hung up, Elodie sat for a few minutes. Penelope had been very pleased, particularly when Elodie reported the suitcase of her mother's recording she now had in her possession. She had suggested that, rather than featuring only one clip of Elodie's mother playing the cello, they might feasibly include another at the end of the ceremony. Elodie had promised to make a shortlist of 3 tracks so that they could look at them together and decide.
"Best make it 5, Penelope had said. "Just in case."
So, that was the weekend sorted. The ferry carrying tourists to Greenwich pulled out from the pier, and a man in a Stars and Stripes cap pointed a long-lens camera at Cleopatra's Needle. A skein of ducks swooped in to take the boat's place, landing expertly on the choppy surface. The ferry left ripples that washed against the low-tide bank, filling the air with the scent of mud and brine, and Elodie thought of a description in James Stratton's journal of the Great Stink of 1858. People didn't realise how badly London had smelled back then. The streets had been covered with animal dung, human waste, rotting vegetables, and the carcasses of slaughtered animals. All of it, and a lot more besides, had found its way into the river. In the summer of 1858, The smell coming in off the Thames was reportedly so fetid that the Palace of Westminster had to be closed and those who could afford it were evacuated from London. The young James Stratton had been inspired to form the Committee to Clean Up London. He'd even published an article in 1862 in a journal called The Builder, agitating for progress. Amongst the archives were letters exchanged between Stratton and Sir Joseph Bazalgette, whose London sewer system was one of the great triumphs of Victorian England, funnelling excrement away from the built-up centre so that not only was the smell improved, but the incidence of waterborne disease was significantly reduced. The thought of Stratton reminded Elodie that she had a workplace she was supposed to be at, and a job she was meant to be doing. She went quickly, mindful of how long it had been since she'd left to meet Pippa, and was glad when she arrived to find that Mr. Pendleton had been called away and would be out of the office for the rest of the day. Eager to capitalise on her return to efficiency, Elodie spent the afternoon cataloguing the remaining items from the lost archive box. The sooner it was filed and finished, the better. She started by running a database search for Radcliffe and was surprised when the results delivered two items. One of the first jobs that Elodie had been assigned when she started at the firm was transferring the index card system onto the computer. She prided herself on having a near photographic memory for the people and places that James Stratton had known and couldn't remember ever having come across the name Radcliffe before. Curious, she fetched the corresponding documents from the file room and brought them back to her desk. The first was an 1861 letter from James Stratton to the art dealer John Haverstock, with whom he'd had plans to dine the following week. In the final paragraph of the letter, Stratton expressed a desire to find out what you know about a painter whose name I came across recently, Edward Radcliffe. I am told he is a man of rare talent, although having had an opportunity to glimpse samples of his work, I observe that his talent, at least in part, is an ability to charm his young female subjects into revealing more than they otherwise might. All in the name of art, naturally. As far as Elodie could remember, James Stratton did not own any of Radcliffe's paintings, though she made a note to confirm that fact. So despite his interest in the painter, he must ultimately have been disinclined to acquire Radcliffe's work. The second mention occurred some years later in Stratton's 1867 journal. At the end of a day's entry, he had written, "The painter, Radcliffe, called to see me this evening. His arrival was unexpected and the hour was very late. I confess to having fallen asleep with my book in hand when the knocker startled me awake. Poor Mabel was abed, and I had to ring to summon her so that refreshments might be brought. I may as well not have bothered and let the weary girl sleep, for Radcliffe did not deign to touch one crumb of the supper provided. He fell, upon arrival, to treading this way and that across the carpet in a most harried state, and could not be calmed. His manner was that of a crazed beast, his eyes wild, and his long hair dishevelled by the constant raking to which it was subjected by his fine pale fingers. He emanated a captured energy, like a man possessed. He muttered as he paced something incomprehensible about curses and fate, a sorry state of affairs indeed, and one that gave me cause for grave concern. I know the loss that he has suffered, better than most. But his grief is wretched to watch. He is a reminder of what heartbreak can do to the most sensitive of souls. I confess that I had heard tell of his ruinous state, but I would not have believed the description had I not seen it with my own eyes. I have determined to do what I can, for it will surely right the scales in some way if I can help him to regain his former self. I encouraged him to stay, assuring him that it was no hardship at all to have a room made up, but he refused. He asked instead that I keep a couple of his personal effects for him, and of course I agreed. He was nervous to make the request, and I sensed that he had not come to see me with the intention of leaving the items. Rather, that the idea had come to him on the spur of the moment. It is only a leather satchel, empty but for a single book of sketches. I would never have broken a confidence to look inside, but he insisted on showing me before he left. He made me swear to keep the bag and sketchbook safe. Poor soul. I did not press him on the question of from whom it is to be kept, and he gave me no answer when I asked as to when he might return. He only looked at me sadly, before thanking me for the supper he did not eat, and leaving. His wretched presence stayed with me afterwards, and is with me even now, as I sit by the dying fire writing this record. The journal extract painted a melancholy picture, and the wretched presence described within its pages lingered with Elodie too. The account answered her question as to how James Stratton came to possess Edward Radcliffe's satchel, but there was still the intriguing question of how Radcliffe had come to know James Stratton well enough in the space of 6 years to turn up at his door in the middle of the night when beset by his private demons. Also, why he had chosen Stratton, of all people, to safeguard his bag and book. Elodie made a note to cross-reference some of the archives of Stratton's friends and associates to see whether Radcliffe's name appeared there. Another wrinkle was Stratton's reference to wanting to right the scales. It was an odd turn of phrase, almost suggesting he had played some part in the man's decline, which made no sense at all. Stratton couldn't have known Edward Radcliffe well. He'd made no mention of the other man in any of the private or public documents within the archive at any time between 1861 and 1867. And it was established fact, according to Pippa and Wikipedia, that Radcliffe had slipped into despair after the death of his fiancée, Frances Brown. The name was not familiar to her within the context of Stratton's archives, but Elodie made another note to cross-reference his associates' papers. She opened a new archive form on her computer and typed in a description of the satchel and sketchbook, adding a brief summary of the letter and journal entry and the corresponding file reference details. Elodie leaned back in her chair and stretched. Two down, one to go. The identity of the woman in the photo, however, was going to be more difficult. There was just so little to work with. The frame was of a fine quality, but then James Stratton had owned very few items that weren't. Elodie attached her magnifying eyepiece and searched the frame for silver markings. She jotted them down on a piece of scrap paper, even as she knew they were unlikely to yield any clues as to the subject of the photo and her relationship to James Stratton. She wondered how the photograph had found its way into Radcliffe's satchel. Was the placement accidental, or was there some meaning to it? It all depended, she supposed, on the identity of the woman. It was possible, of course, that she had not been special to Stratton, and that the frame had, in fact, been placed within the satchel by the great niece to whom the desk had belonged, a random act of storage at some point during the decades after Stratton's death. But it was an outside chance. The way the woman was dressed, the styling, and the look of the photo itself suggested that it, and she, had been contemporaneous with Stratton. Far more likely that he had stored, even concealed, the photograph inside his document holder and slipped it inside the satchel himself. Elodie finished her inspection of the frame, making notes so that she could provide a description of its condition on the archive sheet. A dent at the top, as if it had been dropped, some fine feathery scratches on the back, and then she returned her attention to the woman. Again, the word that came to mind was illuminated. It was something in the quality of the woman's expression, the flow of her hair, the light in her eyes. Elodie realised that she was staring as if she expected the woman to explain herself. But no matter how hard she tried, she could find no identifying feature in the face, the clothing, even the background of the image that suggested where to turn next. Although the photograph was well composed, there was no studio signature in any of the corners, and Elodie wasn't familiar enough with Victorian photography to know whether anything else inherent to the image might give a clue as to its origin. Perhaps Pippa's mentor, Caroline, would be able to help after all. She set the frame down on her desk and rubbed her temples. The photo was going to be a challenge, but she refused to be cowed. The detective thrill of the chase was one of the best parts of her job, a counterbalance to the satisfying but repetitive work of creating neat records. "I'll find you," she said softly. Make no mistake about that.
Talking to yourself again.
Margot was beside Elodie's desk, hunting through the handbag she had slung across her shoulder.
First sign of trouble, you know.
She found a tin of peppermints and shook them, dropping a couple into Elodie's waiting palm.
Staying late.
Elodie glanced at the clock, surprised to find that it was already 5:30.
Not tonight. Alistair picking you up?
He's in New York.
Again? You must be missing him. Don't know what I'd do without Gary to go home to.
Elodie agreed that she was missing her fiancé, and Margot gave her a sympathetic smile, which turned swiftly into a cheery farewell. Fishing her neon earbuds out of her bag, she swiped her iPhone and sashayed off into the weekend. The office resettled into papery silence. The strip of sunlight had arrived on the far wall and was beginning its daily approach towards her desk. Elodie cracked one of the mints open with her back teeth and hit print on the archive label she'd made for the new box. She started to tidy her desk, a task she performed religiously on Friday afternoons so that she could begin the upcoming week with a clean slate. Not that she'd admit it, and certainly not to Margot, but there was a small part of Elodie that looked forward to Alistair's weeks in New York. She missed him, of course, but it was restful in some way knowing that for 6 whole nights she could stay at her own place in her own bed with her own books and her favourite teacup without having to negotiate and explain herself. It was true what he said. Her flat was tiny, and there was that old chip grease smell in the stairwell, whereas his was large with 2 bathrooms and always enough hot water and never any need to listen to the neighbour's television through the whisper-thin floors. But Elodie was fond of her little flat. Yes, there was a trick to getting the kitchen sink to drain properly, and the shower only ever managed a half flow when the washing machine was running a cycle, but it felt like the sort of place where real human lives could be and had been led. There was history in its natty old cupboards and creaking floorboards, the loo that was reached only by climbing 3 carpeted stairs. Alistair seemed to consider it endearing that she found comfort in such diminished surrounds.
"You should be staying at my place when I'm away," he always said, his place being a sleek apartment in Canary Wharf. "You don't need to go back to your lair."
"I'm happy here."
"Here? Really?"
They'd had a variation on the same conversation at least 15 times, and he always reserved his most sceptical glance for deployment at this point. Its target invariably the corner in which Elodie had arranged her dad's old velvet armchair beneath the fairy-lighted shelf of treasures. The painting Mrs. Berry had presented to her when she turned 30. The charm box Tip gave her after her mother died. A framed strip of funfair photos taken with Pippa when they were both 13. Alistair favoured mid-century Danish design and believed that if an item couldn't be purchased from the Conran shop, it had no business being on display at all. Elodie's flat was homely, he was willing to concede, but only before adding,
"Of course, you'll have to give it up when we're married. We can't very well put the crib in the bathroom."
Obviously, it was churlish to feel anything other than excited at the prospect of living in such a grand, glossy place, but Elodie just wasn't a very grand, glossy person, and she was terrible with change. Little wonder. This was the psychologist she'd seen for a time when she first went up to Oxford. "You lost your mother. It's one of the most significant and frightening changes that a child can experience." Such loss, Elodie was reliably informed by Dr. Judith Davies. Call me Jude. After 3 months of weekly sessions in the warm front room of her Edwardian house, couldn't help but embed itself within a person's psyche.
"You mean it's going to affect my every life decision?"
Elodie had asked.
"I do."
"Forever?"
"Most likely."
She had stopped seeing Dr. Davies, It's Jude, soon after that. There hadn't seemed much point, though she had missed the pot of citrus mint tea that appeared on the scuffed wooden table at the start of each session. The doctor had been right. Elodie had got no better with change. Picturing other people in her flat, hanging their pictures on the hooks she'd hammered into the wall, arranging their teacups on the sill where she grew her herbs, enjoying the view from her window,
gave Elodie the same dread feeling she'd experienced sometimes on holiday when she woke in an unfamiliar room, utterly lost because none of her touchstones were there. She hadn't had the heart to break the news about the move to her landlady yet. Mrs. Berry was 84 years old and had grown up in the house in Barnes when it was still a family home and not 3.5 flats above a fish and chip shop. She lived now in the garden flat behind the shop.
"This used to be my mother's morning room," she liked to reminisce after a glass or two of her favourite sherry. "Such a lady she was, such a fine lady. Oh, not in the aristocratic sense. I don't mean that. It was just her nature."
Mrs. Berry's eyes took on a particular shine when she started to slip into the past and she became less careful with her cards.
"What are trumps?" she'd ask at the start of each round. "Spades or was it curlies?"
Elodie was going to have to cancel the game they'd penciled in for that evening. She'd promised Penelope a list of recordings and a selection of clips by Monday. Now she was on a roll, she couldn't let anything get in the way of ticking items off her list. She shut down the computer and capped her pen, lining it up against the top of the jotting pad. The desk was clear except for the satchel, the sketchbook, and the framed photograph. The first two could be reboxed and stored. The last faced another weekend amidst the jumble of office supplies within the lost box. Before tucking the photograph away, Elodie took a picture with her phone just as Pippa had done. She would need it if she were to give more thought to her dress. It wouldn't hurt to look at it beside the veil either. After a moment's hesitation, she took a photo of the house in the sketchbook too, not because she was allowing herself any longer to entertain the notion that it was somehow magically the house from her mother's fairy tale. She took the photo simply because she liked the sketch. It was beautiful, and it made her feel things, a connection to her mother, and a tethering to the unbroken part of her childhood. And then Elodie slipped the satchel and sketchbook into a new archive box, affixed the label she'd printed off, and filed them in the storeroom on her way out of the door and into the busy London street. 3. Mrs. Mack used to say that a needy man's budget was full of schemes. She'd say that sort of thing whenever she wanted one of us to try a new scam. We kids that lived like rats in the runners within the set of small rooms above the bird shop on Little White Lion Street. I've been thinking about Mrs. Mack lately, and Martin, and Lily, and the captain, and even Pale Joe. He was the first person I ever truly loved. The second, if you include my father, which I don't always. Mrs. Mack was kind enough in her way. It was a way that included plenty of beatings for those that got on her wrong side and a tongue so sharp it lashed, but she was fairer than most, in her way. She was good to me. She took me in when I was desperate. I believe she even loved me. I betrayed her in the end, but only when I had to. It is different on this side. Human beings are curators. Each polishes his or her own favoured memories, arranging them in order to create a narrative that pleases. Some events are repaired and buffed for display. Others are deemed unworthy and cast aside, shelved below ground in the overflowing storeroom of the mind. There, with any luck, they are promptly forgotten. The process is not dishonest. It is the only way that people can live with themselves and the weight of their experiences. But it is different over here. I remember everything. Memories forming different pictures depending on the order in which they fall. Time passes differently when I'm alone in the house. I have no way of marking the years. I am aware that the sun continues to rise and set, and the moon to take its place, but I no longer feel its passage. Past, present, and future are meaningless. I am outside time. Here and there, and there and here, at once. My visitor has been with me for 5 of his days now. I was surprised when he first arrived, with his scuffed suitcase and that brown bag over his shoulder, which makes me think of Edward's satchel, even more so when the doors were locked on the house that night and he remained.
It has been a long while since anyone stayed here overnight. Ever since the Art Historians Association opened the house to the public, I have seen only weekend day trippers with sensible shoes and tour books. The people from the association have put the young man in the rooms of the old malt house, part of the closed area that was once used briefly to accommodate a caretaker and into which the visiting public are not permitted. It wouldn't do to have him take up residence inside the house, for it is set up like a museum now. Antique furniture, much of it from Edward's own collection, purchased with the house when he bought it, has been arranged, taking care to leave room for the tourists to mill about on weekends. Bunches of lavender with velvet bows have been placed on the seats so that no one tries to use them as intended. Just before my clock strikes 10 each Saturday morning, a group of volunteers arrives, positioning themselves about the house so that there is one per room. They wear tags that read guide around their necks, and it is their job to remind people, do not touch. They are primed with partially correct historical anecdotes, so that when they catch the eye of a half-willing tourist, they can ensnare them with their spiel. There is one in particular, Mildred Manning, who likes to sit on a Quaker-style chair at the top of the attic staircase, baring her teeth in a grim approximation of a smile. Nothing makes her happier than to catch an unwitting guest in the process of setting down their pamphlet on the table beside her. This infraction grants her the prized opportunity to intone that nothing should be placed upon Edward Radcliffe's furniture. Edward would have hated her. He couldn't bear the zealous overprotection of things. He believed that beautiful objects should be cherished but not revered. And so, with Edward in mind, some days, when the year is creeping towards autumn, I spend my afternoons draped around Mildred's shoulders. No amount of clothing can keep a person warm when I get too close. I have taken a preliminary inventory. My visitor's hair is dirty blonde in colour, and his skin is sun-browned. His hands are weathered and capable. They are not the fine hands of a painter. They are the hands of a man who knows how to use the tools that he carries with him when he heads out on his daily rounds. He has been very busy since he arrived. He wakes early before sunrise, and although he does not seem pleased about the fact, groaning and then squinting at the phone that he keeps beside his bed to tell the time, he nonetheless elects to rise rather than to remain in bed. He makes a cup of tea, quickly and sloppily, and then showers and dresses, always in the same clothing, a T-shirt and faded blue denim jeans, tossed the night before across the bentwood chair in the corner. Whatever it is that he is doing requires him to frown at a map of the manor grounds and a series of handwritten notes. I have taken to standing at a distance behind him as I try to discover what it is that he is up to. But it is no use. The handwriting is too small and faint to read, and I dare not go nearer. We have not yet been acquainted long enough for me to know how close I can get. I can be an oppressive companion, and I do not wish to scare him off. Yet. And so I wait. I do at least know what it is he keeps in that brown bag of his. He unpacked it last night. It is a camera. A proper camera of the sort that Felix might recognise were he to rematerialise suddenly in the here and now. Something that Felix would not recognise, however, is the way my visitor is able to connect the camera to a computer and have the images appear like magic upon the screen. No need any more for a dark room or developing solutions with their acrid smell. I watched last night as he scrolled through picture after picture, photographs of the churchyard, headstones mainly. No one that I knew, but I was transfixed all the same. It was the first time in many years that I have been able to leave this place. What do his photographs tell me about his purpose here? I wonder. Not nearly enough. He is out there somewhere now. He has been gone since breakfast time. But I am patient, far more patient now than before. I have been watching from the window in the stairwell, looking beyond the chestnut tree towards my old friend, the Thames. I do not expect my young man to return that way. and like others who came to Birchwood before him, he does not favour the river. He considers it at times, as one might a painting, but only from a distance, and not, I think, with pleasure. No boat rides for him thus far. No, I watched the river for myself. The Thames flowed through my life just as surely as blood flows through a body. I can only go as far now as the wall of the field barn in the north, the Haffordstead Brook to the west, the orchard to the east, and the Japanese maple in the south. I have tried to travel further over the years, but alas, to no avail. The sensation, if I dare, is like an anchor being pulled. I do not understand the physics. I only know that it is so. My visitor is not as young as I first thought. He is muscular and able, with the pulsing physicality of an animal made to come inside against his will. But there is something that weighs on him. Hardships tell upon a man. My father aged by a decade during the months after my mother's death, when the landlord began to knock on our door, and the two of them engaged in tense discussions that became more and more heated over time, until at last, on a bleak wintry day, the landlord shouted that he'd been as patient as a saint, that he wasn't a charity, and it was high time my father found himself a new situation. My visitor's hardship is of a different nature. He keeps a printed photograph inside a scuffed leather wallet. I have seen him take it out late at night and pore over it. The image is of two small children, little more than babies. One of them grins with juicy happiness at the camera. The other is more circumspect. The way he frowns at that photograph, the way he rubs his thumb across its surface, as if by doing so he might enlarge it and permit himself a closer view, makes me certain that they are his. And then, last night, he made a call on his mobile telephone to someone he called Sarah. He has a warm voice and was polite, but I could see by the way he clenched his pen and clawed his hand in his hair that he was struggling. He said, "But that was a long time ago." And, "You'll see, I've changed." And, "Surely I deserve a second chance." As all the while, he stared at the photograph, worrying its top left corner with his fingertips. It was that conversation which put me in mind of my own father, because before Mrs. Mack and the captain, there was my father, always looking for his second chance. He was a clockmaker by trade, a master craftsman, his skill unsurpassed, and his expertise sought by those with the most elaborate timepieces to repair. "Each clock is unique," he used to tell me, "and just like a person, its face, whether plain or pretty, is but a mask for the intricate mechanism it conceals." I went with him sometimes on repair jobs. He called me his helper, but I did not really help. When he was ushered into the library or study, I was invariably taken downstairs by a dutiful serving maid into one of the vast steaming kitchens that fueled the stately houses of England. Each had a rotund cook labouring away in her engine room, pink of cheek, sweaty of brow, keeping the larders stocked with sweet lumpy jam and fresh loaves of bread. My father used to tell me that my mother had grown up in such a house. She had been sitting in the grand upstairs window, he said, when he arrived to mend her father's clock. Their eyes had met, they'd fallen in love, and nothing after that could keep them apart. Her parents had tried. Her little sister had pleaded with her to stay, but my mother was headstrong and young and used to being indulged, and so she ran away. Children, as a rule, are literal creatures, and whenever I heard this story, I pictured my mother running, her skirts flying behind her in a satin wake as she fled from the looming castle, leaving behind her beloved sister and the raging horror of her overbearing parents. This is what I believed. My father had to tell me stories, as I did not have the chance myself to know my mother. She was 2 days shy of 21 when she died, and I a child of 4. It was consumption that killed her, but my father had the coroner put bronchitis on her death certificate, as he thought it sounded more refined. He needn't have bothered. Having married my father and left the bosom of her titled family, She was removed to the great mass of ordinary people of whom history takes no account. There was a single likeness, a small sketch that he kept inside a gold locket and which I treasured. Until that is, we were forced to move into the pair of draughty rooms in the pinched alleyway in a pocket of East London, where the smell of the Thames was always in our noses and the calls of gulls and sailors mingled to form a constant song, and the locket disappeared to the rag and bone man. I do not know where the likeness went. It slipped through the cracks of time and went to where the lost things are. My father called me Birdie. He said I was his little bird. My real name was Beautiful, he said, but it was the name of a grown-up lady, the sort of name that wore long skirts and fine silks, but had not the wings to fly. Do I want a name with wings? Oh, yes, I should think so. Then why did you give me one without? He became earnest then, as he always did when talk grazed the subject of her. You were named for your mother's father. It was important to her that you should carry something of her family.
Even if they did not wish to know me?
Even if. He said with a smile, and then he ruffled my hair, which never failed to make me feel assured, as if no deprivation could matter in the face of his love. My father's workshop was a place of wonder. The great tall bench beneath the window was a sea of springs and rivets, scales and wires, bells, pendulums and fine arrow hands. I used to sneak in through the open door to kneel on a wooden stool and explore the bench while he was working, turning over the curious and clever contraptions, gently pressing the tiny fragile parts beneath my fingertips, holding the different metals in the streaming sun to make them shine. I asked question after question, and he appeared over his glasses to answer. But he made me promise not to breathe a word to anyone about the things that I observed. For my father was not merely repairing clocks. He was working on an invention of his own. His great project was the creation of a mystery clock, the construction of which involved long sessions at his workbench and frequent surreptitious visits to the Court of Chancery where patents of invention were enrolled and issued. My father said that the mystery clock, when he mastered it, would make our fortune. For which man of means would not desire a clock whose pendulum appeared to move without the benefit of a mechanism? I nodded solemnly when he said such things. The gravity with which he spoke required it, but in truth I was equally impressed by the regular clocks that lined his walls from floor to ceiling, their hearts beating, their pendulums swinging in constant gentle dissonance. He showed me how to wind them, and I would stand back in the centre of the room afterwards, gazing at their mismatched faces as they tut-tut-tutted me in chorus.
But which one shows the right time?
I would ask. Ah, little bird, the better question is, which one doesn't? There was no such thing as the right time, he explained. Time was an idea. It had no end and no beginning. It could not be seen or heard or smelled. It could be measured, sure enough, but no words had been found to explain precisely what it was. As to the right time, it was simply a matter of agreeing to agree.
Do you remember the woman on the railway platform? He asked.
I told him that I did. I had been playing one morning while my father repaired the large clock at the station west of London when I noticed a smaller version hanging on the wall by the ticket office. I'd stopped what I was doing and was looking between the two disparate faces when a woman came up beside me.
That there's the real time, she explained, pointing at the little dial. And that one?
She frowned at the clock my father had just finished winding.
That there's London time.
Which is how I learned that while I could not be in two places at once, I could most certainly be in one place at two times. Soon after my father suggested that we take a trip to Greenwich, the home of the meridian. Greenwich Meridian. The new words were like an incantation.
A line from which time begins, he continued. From the north to the south pole, it splits the earth in two. So impressive did this sound, so vivid was my child's imagination, that I suppose it was inevitable the reality would disappoint. Our journey took us to the well-tended lawn of a grand stone palace, from which I searched in vain for the great jagged tear I had envisaged in the earth's surface. "There it is," he indicated with a straightened arm. "Right in front of you, a direct line, 0 degrees longitude."
"But I cannot see anything. All I see is grass."
He laughed when I said that, and ruffled my hair, and asked whether I would like to take a look through the Royal Observatory Telescope instead. We took the journey along the river to Greenwich a number of times in the months before my mother died, and on the boat back and forth my father taught me how to read. The words in books, the tides in the river, the expressions of the faces of our fellow travellers. He showed me how to tell the time by the sun. Human beings had ever been captivated by the great burning sphere in the heavens, he said, for not only does it give us warmth, but also light, the foremost craving of our souls. Light. I took to watching it on the spring trees, noticing how it turned the delicate new leaves translucent. I observed the way it threw shadows against walls, tossed stardust across the surface of the water, made filigree on the ground where it fell through wrought iron railings. I wanted to touch it, this marvellous tool, to hold it in my fingertips the way I did the tiny objects on my father's workbench. It became my mission to capture light. I found a small hinged tin, emptied of its contents, and drove a nail through the top several times with one of my father's hammers to make tiny perforations. I took the contraption outside with me, sat it in the sunniest place that I could find, and waited until the top was burning hot. Alas, when I slid the box of wonder open, there was no glittering captive waiting for me. It was just the empty inside of a rusty old tin. Mrs. Mack used to say that when it rained, it poured, which wasn't a comment on the weather, although it took me a while to work that out, but an observation of the way misfortune seemed to invite further misfortune. After my mother died, it began to pour for my father and me. For one thing, it was the end of our trips to Greenwich. For another, we saw a lot more of Jeremiah. He was my father's friend, of sorts, the two of them having grown up in the same village. He had visited occasionally when my mother was alive, for my father had taken him along sometimes as an apprentice on large railway clock repair jobs. But I was aware, in the vague, instinctive manner of small children, that Jeremiah was a source of tension between them. I can remember my father offering placatory assurances like, "He does the best with what God gave him," or "He means well." And reminding her that although Jeremiah had been blessed with few of life's gifts, he was a good fellow really and certainly very enterprising. The latter was undeniably true. Jeremiah turned his hand to whatever opportunity came his way. He was by turns a rag and bone man, a tanner, and at one time became convinced his fortune lay in the door-to-door distribution of Steele's aromatic lozenges, the professed benefits of which included magnificent male stamina. After my mother's death, when my father began his tumble into the dark crevasse of grief, Jeremiah started taking him out for long stretches in the afternoon, the pair of them stumbling back after dark, my father half asleep and slumped across his friend's shoulder. Jeremiah would then bed down for the night on the sofa in our drawing room, all the better to help us out the following day. And my father had longer days to fill by then. His hands had started to shake and he had lost the ability to concentrate. He received fewer offers of work, which in turn made him bitter. Jeremiah, though, was always there to prop him up. He convinced my father that he'd been wasting his time on repairs anyway, that his future lay in perfecting his mystery clock. That with Jeremiah as his agent, they couldn't help but make a fortune. When the landlord finally reached the end of his patience, it was Jeremiah, through his contacts, who helped my father to find rooms in a building that huddled in the shadows of the steeple of St. Anne's. He seemed to know a lot of people, and always had an opinion to venture, and a bit of business to transact. It was Jeremiah who oversaw the sale of my father's patents, and Jeremiah who told me not to worry when the bailiff started knocking on the door at all hours, complaining that my father owed him money. He knew a man who ran a gambling outfit in the Limehouse, he said. All my father needed was a little bit of luck to see him right. And when my father took to spending every night down at the public house on Narrow Street, dragging himself back at first light, smelling of tobacco and whiskey, to collapse at the empty table with his pipe, when he sold off the last of his brass and rivets in order to pay his gambling debts, it was Jeremiah who shook his head sadly and said,
"Your old man's just unlucky. I never did meet a man with an unluckier star."
The bailiff continued to knock, but my father ignored him. He began instead to talk obsessively about America. In his battered state, the idea made perfect sense. We would leave behind the sorrow and unhappy memories and start afresh in a new place.
"There's land, little bird," he said, "and sunshine for the taking, and rivers that run clean and soil that can be turned over without fear of unearthing bones from the past."
He sold the last of Mother's dresses, pieces that he had been saving for me, and booked cheap passage for us both on the next ship to America. We packed our possessions, such as they were, in one small suitcase apiece. The week that we were due to leave was cold, the first snow of the season, and my father was eager that we should have as much extra coin as possible for the journey. We spent each day down by the river, where a supply ship had recently overturned and there were prizes hidden in the mud for those that wanted most to find them. We laboured each hour from dawn until dusk, through rain, sleet and snow. Mud larking was ever tiring work, but one evening I was more exhausted than usual. I fell upon my mattress, soaking wet, and was unable to rise. The dizziness came on suddenly, along with aches that made my bones feel cold and heavy. My teeth chattered even as my forehead burned, and the world began to darken as surely as if someone had pulled down its curtains. I was adrift, my perception as unsteady as a small wooden boat in rough seas. I heard my father's voice sometimes, and Jeremiah's, but they were brief snatches followed by long stretches of surrender to the vivid stories in my mind's eye. Dreams, most fruity and peculiar. My fever raced, creating shadows and jagged monsters in the room. They lurched across the walls, widening their crazy eyes, reaching their taloned fingers to grab at my bedclothes. I turned and twisted away from them, my sheets wet from the exertion, my lips moving around incantations that seemed of vital importance. Words pierced my delusions like hot needles, familiar words like doctor, fever, America, that had once held meaning and importance. And then I heard Jeremiah say,
"You must go. The bailiff will be back, and he's promised to put you in jail this time, or worse." "But the child, my little bird, she's not well enough to travel. Leave her here. Send for her when you're settled. There are people who will mind a child for a small fee."
My lungs, my throat, my mind all burned with the effort to shout, "No." But whether the word passed my lips, I could not tell.
"She depends on me," said my father. "Worse then, if the judge decides that you must pay for your debts with your life."
I wanted to shout, to reach out and grab my father, to cleave him to me so that we could never be parted. But it was no use. The monsters pulled me under again and I heard no more. Day dissolved into night. My boat pushed out once more into stormy seas. And that is the last I remember of that. The next thing I knew, it was morning, bright, and the first sound to my ears was of birds calling outside the window. But these were not the birds that sing of morning's arrival here at Birchwood Manor, or those that used to nest beneath the sill in our little house in Fulham. This was a great cacophony of birds, hundreds of them squawking and jeering in languages foreign to my ears. A church bell pealed, and I recognised it at once as the bell of St. Anne's, but it was different somehow from the sound that I knew so well. I was a shipwrecked sailor, washed up on a foreign shore. And then a voice, a woman's voice I did not know. "She's waking."
"Papa?"
I tried to say, but my throat was dry and a mere airy sound arrived.
"Shh, there now," said the woman. "There now, Mrs. Mac is here. Everything's going to be all right."
I cracked open my eyes to find a large figure looming above me. Beyond, I saw that my little suitcase was on a table by the window. Someone had opened the lid and my clothing was sitting now in a neat pile beside the case.
"Who are you?"
I managed to say.
"Why, I'm Mrs. Mac, of course, and this lad here is Martin, and that over there's the captain."
There was a note of cheery impatience in her voice. I looked about, absorbing quickly the unfamiliar surrounds and the strange people to whom she was pointing.
"Papa,"
I started to cry.
"Shh, Lordy child, there's no need to blubber. You know very well that your father's gone on to America, and we'll send for you when he's ready. In the meantime, he's asked that Mrs. Mac look after you."
"Where am I?"
She laughed.
"Why, child, you're at home, of course. Now stop that bawling or else the wind might change and spoil that pretty face of yours."
And so I was born twice. Once to my mother and father in a small room in our family home in Fulham, on a fresh summer's night when the moon was full and the stars were bright and the river was a shimmery skinned snake beneath the window. And once again to Mrs. Mac when I was 7 years old, in her house tucked above the shop selling birds in cages, in the area of Covent Garden referred to as the Seven Dials. Chapter 6. Summer 2017. Mrs. Berry was out amongst the hollyhocks and larkspur when Elodie arrived home from work. The garden door at the back of the hall was wide open and Elodie could see her old landlady inspecting the blooms. It never failed to amaze her how someone who relied on Coke bottle glasses to tell the difference between diamonds and hearts could remain such a sharp shooter when it came to the grubs on her flowers. Rather than duck straight upstairs, Elodie went down the hall, past Mrs. Berry's grandfather clock, still softly, patiently sweeping time aside, to stop at the doorway.
"Are you winning?"
"Scoundrels!" Mrs. Berry called back, plucking a fat green caterpillar from a leaf and holding it up for Elodie's distant inspection. "Sneaky little devils and greedy too, frightfully greedy."
She dropped the offender into an old jam jar with a smattering of others.
"Fancy a drink?"
"Love one."
Elodie dropped her bag on the concrete step and headed out into the summery garden. A quick Friday catch-up and then she'd start on the recordings, as she promised Penelope. Mrs. Berry set the jar of Wrigley's on the elegant iron table beneath the apple tree and disappeared into her kitchen. At 84, she was exceptionally spry, a fact she credited to her refusal to earn a driving licence.
"Terrible polluting machines, and the way people charge about in them, dreadful, much better to walk."
She reappeared carrying a tray loaded with a jug fizzing orange. Mrs. Berry had been on a trip to Tuscany with her watercolour group the previous year and had developed a penchant for Aperol spritz. She filled a generous glass for each of them and passed one across the table.
"Salute."
"Cheers."
"I sent that RSVP of yours off today."
"Brilliant news. That's one, at least, for my side of the church."
"And I've been giving more thought to my reading. There's a lovely Rossetti. Reads like a piece of Morris fabric. All peacocks and fruit and halcyon seas."
"Sounds divine."
"But trivial. Too trivial for you. I prefer the Tennyson. If I were loved as I desire to be, what is there in the great sphere of the earth and range of evil between death and birth that I should fear if I were loved by thee?"
She was smiling beatifically, a small hand planted on her heart.
"Oh, Elodie, what truth, what liberty, what joy to be released from life's fear by the simple knowledge of love."
Elodie found herself nodding with equal enthusiasm.
It's beautiful, isn't it? There's the small matter of what Alistair's mother will think of a wedding reading that describes life as a range of evil between death and birth. Pah! What business is it of hers?
Well, none, I suppose.
It's not the point of the poem anyway. The point is that no matter what evil might come one's way, to be loved is to be protected.
Do you think that's true?
Mrs. Berry smiled.
Did I ever tell you how I met my husband?
Elodie shook her head. Mr. Berry had died before she moved into the attic flat. She'd seen photos of him, though, lots of photos of a beaming man with glasses and a rim of white hair around an otherwise smooth pate. They were all over the walls and atop the sideboards in Mrs. Berry's flat.
We were children. His name was Bernstein back then. He came to England on one of the trains from Germany at the start of the Second War. The Kinder transport, you know. My mother and father had put their names down as foster parents, and in June 1939 we were sent Thomas. I still remember the night he arrived. We opened the door, and there he was, all alone, skinny legs, and a battered suitcase in hand. Funny little thing, with his very dark hair and eyes, and not a word of English. Ever so polite, he sat at the dinner table and endured my mother's attempt at sauerkraut, and was then taken upstairs to the room they'd made up specially. I was fascinated, of course. I asked many times for a brother. And there was a fissure in the wall back then between my room and his, a mouse hole that my father had never got around to fixing. I used to spy through it, and that's how I knew he lay down each night in the bed my mother had prepared. But when the house got dark and quiet, he carried his blanket and pillow to the cupboard and climbed inside to sleep. I think it was this that made me love him. He had a single photograph with him when he arrived, wrapped up with a letter from his parents. He told me later that his mother had sewn the little parcel inside the lining of his jacket so it couldn't get lost along the way. He kept it all his life, that photograph. His two smartly dressed parents and he a happy little lad between them, with no idea of what was coming. They died at Auschwitz, both of them. We found that out later. We got married as soon as I turned 16, and the two of us went off to Germany together. There was so much confusion after the war, still so much horror to be sorted through, even then. He was very brave. I kept waiting for it to hit him, all that he'd lost. When we learned that we couldn't have children, when his best friend and business partner swindled him and it looked like we might be bankrupted, when I discovered a lump in my breast, he was always so brave, so resilient, I suppose. That seems to be the word du jour. It wasn't that he didn't feel things. Many's the time I saw him weep. But he dealt with his disappointment, with his hardship and grief. He picked himself up and went on, every time. And not like a mad person who refuses to recognise adversity, but like someone who accepts that life is inherently unfair, that the only truly fair thing about it is the randomness of its unfairness.
She topped up their glasses.
I'm telling you all this, not because I feel like a stroll down memory lane or because I like to tell my young friends sad stories on sunny Friday evenings. I just wanted you to understand. I wanted you to see what a balm love is. What it is to share one's life, to really share it, so that very little matters outside the certainty of its walls. Because the world is very noisy, Elodie. And although life is filled with joy and wonder, there's evil and sorrow and injustice too.
There was little Elodie could think to say. To utter agreement in the face of such hard-won wisdom sounded glib. And really, what of life's experience did she have to add to the thoughts of her 84-year-old friend anyway? Mrs. Berry didn't appear to expect a response. She was sipping from her drink, her attention focused on something beyond Elodie's shoulder, and so Elodie fell to her own musing. She realised that she hadn't heard from Alistair all day. Penelope had mentioned on the phone that he'd had the meeting with the New York board and that it had all gone very well. Perhaps he was out with his colleagues celebrating the merger. Elodie was still not entirely sure what it was that Alistair's company did, something to do with acquisitions. He had explained it more than once. It was all about consolidation, he said, the joining of two entities so that their combined value might be increased. But Elodie was always left with the sort of questions a child might think to ask. In her line of work, an acquisition referred to the delivery and possession of an object. Something solid and real that could be held in one's hands, and which told a story through its every mark.
"When Thomas was dying," said Mrs. Berry, picking up the thread of her story, "right towards the very end, I started to fret. I was so worried that he'd be frightened. I didn't want him to have to go alone. At night, my dreams were filled with the image of that little boy, alone on our doorstep. I didn't say anything, but we'd always been able to read each other's thoughts, and one day he turned his head towards me, unprompted, and told me that he'd never been frightened of anything in life since the day we met."
Her eyes glistened, and her voice filled with wonder.
"Do you hear that? Nothing in life had had the power to frighten him, because he knew how much I loved him."
Elodie had a lump in her throat.
"I wish I'd known him." "I wish you had too. He'd have liked you."
Mrs. Berry took a large sip of her drink. A starling swooped down to land on the table between them, eyeing the jar of grubs keenly before giving a loud call and removing himself to a bough of the apple tree for a further inspection. Elodie smiled and Mrs. Berry laughed.
"How about you stay for dinner?" she said. "I'll tell you a happier story about the time Thomas and I accidentally bought a farm. Then I'm planning to beat your socks off. I have my deck shuffled and ready to go."
"Oh, Mrs. Berry, I'd really love to, but I can't tonight."
"Not even cards?"
"I'm afraid not. I'm on a deadline."
"More work? You work too hard, you know."
"Not this time. It's wedding business."
"Wedding business? Honestly, people do complicate things these days. What more do you need than two people who love one another and someone to hear them say it? If you ask me, even the latter's surplus to requirements. If I had my time again, I'd run away to Tuscany and speak my vows to my Thomas on the edge of one of those medieval hilltop villages, with the sun on my face and a wreath of honeysuckle in my hair. And then I'd enjoy a jolly good bottle of Chianti."
"Is there any other sort?"
"That's my girl."
Upstairs, Elodie kicked off her shoes and opened the windows. The honeysuckle from Mrs. Berry's garden had grown voraciously over the summer, clinging to the brick back of the house, so that its fragrance drifted up on the warm afternoon breeze to infuse the flat. She knelt on the floor and opened the suitcase of tapes her father had packed for her. Elodie recognised the suitcase as one he'd bought about 12 years earlier when she convinced him to go on a classical music tour in Vienna. It had seen better days and was an unprepossessing choice to hold such precious cargo. No one would have guessed that it held his heart, which Elodie supposed was part of his thought process. All the better to keep it safe. There were at least 30 video cassettes inside, all labelled meticulously in her father's careful hand, by date, concert, location and piece of music. Thanks to Mrs. Berry, Elodie was in possession of what was surely one of the last video players in London, and she connected it now to the back of her TV. She chose a tape at random and inserted it into the player. Suddenly, nerves swirled in her stomach. The tape had not been rewound fully, and the room filled immediately with music. Lauren Adler, celebrated cello soloist and Elodie's mother, was in close-up on the screen. She hadn't started yet, but was embracing the cello, its neck entwined with her own as the orchestra played behind her. She was very young in this video, Her chin was lifted, her eyes fixed on the conductor. Long hair cascaded over her shoulders and down her back. She was waiting. The stage lights illuminated one side of her face, throwing the other into dramatic shadow. She was wearing a black satin dress with shoestring straps, and her fine arms, deceptively strong, were bare. She wore no jewellery except for her simple gold wedding band. Her fingers resting on the strings were poised ready. The conductor was on screen now, a man in a white bow tie and black jacket. He brought the orchestra to a pause and after a few seconds of silence nodded at Lauren Adler. She drew breath and then she and her cello began their dance. Amongst the many articles Elodie had devoured about her mother, one adjective had appeared over and over. Adler's talent was sublime. The critics all agreed. She had been put on earth to play the cello and each piece of music, no matter how well known, was reborn in her hands. Elodie's father had kept all of the obituaries, but the one from the Times had pleased him especially, and so it had been framed to hang on the wall amongst the stage photos. Elodie had read it many times and there was a passage that always stuck in her memory. Lauren Adler's talent opened a fissure in ordinary experience through which purity and clarity and truth could be glimpsed. That was her gift to her audience. Through Lauren Adler's music, they experienced what religious people might call God. The label on the videotape said that this performance had taken place at the Royal Albert Hall in 1987, and that the piece of music was Dvorak's cello concerto in B minor. Opus 104. Elodie jotted a note. Her mother was playing unaccompanied now, and the orchestra, a blurred sea of women with straight faces and men with dark-rimmed glasses, sat very still behind her. The heart-stripping cello notes sent a shiver up Elodie's spine. Lauren Adler had believed that a recording was a dead thing. She'd given an interview to the Times in which she'd said so, going on to describe live performance as the precipice on which fear, anticipation and joy met, a unique experience shared between audience and performer, which lost all potency when pressed into permanence. But the recording was all Elodie had. She had no memories of her mother, the musician. She'd been taken to see her play once or twice when she was a very small child, and of course she'd heard her practicing at home, but Elodie couldn't actually remember hearing her mother play professionally. Not that she could separate her from her experience of other concerts performed by other musicians. She would never have confessed as much to her father, who was wholly invested in the idea that Elodie carried those memories inside her, moreover, that they were an intrinsic part of who she was.
"Your mother used to play for you when she was pregnant," he'd told her more times than she could count. "She used to say that the human heartbeat was the first music that a person heard, and that every child was born knowing the rhythm of her mother's song."
He often spoke to Elodie as if she shared his memories.
"Remember when she played for the Queen and the audience stood in ovation at the end for over 3 minutes? Remember the night she performed all 6 Bach cello suites at the proms?"
Elodie didn't remember. She didn't know her mother at all. She closed her eyes. Her father was part of the problem. His grief was just so pervasive. Rather than allowing the chasm left when Lauren Adler died to close, even to help it close, his own sorrow, his refusal to let her go, had kept it wide open. One day in the weeks following the accident, Elodie had been in the garden when she overheard a couple of well-meaning women who'd come to offer consolation and were now returning to their car.
"Good thing the child's so young," one of them had said to the other as they reached the front gate. "She'll grow up and forget, and she'll never know what she's missing."
They were right in part. Elodie had forgotten. She simply had too few memories of her own with which to fill the hole made by her mother's death. But they were wrong too, for Elodie knew exactly what she was missing. She hadn't been allowed to forget. Now she opened her eyes. It was dark outside. Night had swept the dusk aside. Inside, the television screen was fizzing with static. Elodie hadn't noticed when the music stopped. She climbed off the window seat and ejected the tape, selecting another to replace it. This one was labelled Mozart String Quintet No. 3 in C major. K515, Carnegie Hall, 1985. And Elodie stood watching the preamble for a few minutes. The video had been shot documentary style, starting with a biographical introduction to the five young string players, three women and two men, coming together in New York to perform together. As the narrator spoke about each one in turn, the footage showed her mother in a rehearsal room, laughing with the others while a violinist with dark curly hair joked around with his bow. Elodie recognised him as her mother's friend, the American violinist who had been driving the car from Bath to London on the day they were both killed. She remembered him vaguely. His family had come to dinner once or twice when they were visiting London from the States. And, of course, she'd seen his photograph in some of the newspaper articles published after the accident. There'd been a couple, too, amongst the boxes of loose photos at home that her father had never got around to sorting. She watched him for a moment as the camera followed his movements, trying to decide how she felt about this man who had unwittingly taken her mother from her. He would remain linked to Lauren Adler forever by the circumstances of their deaths. But all she could think was how impossibly young he looked, and how much talent he possessed, and how right Mrs. Berry was that life's only nod to fairness was the blindness with which it dealt unfair blows. After all, he had left a young family behind too. Lauren Adler was on screen now. It was true what all the newspaper columns said. She had been breathtaking. Elodie watched as the group performed in concert, jotting down notes as she considered whether the piece would be a good choice for the wedding ceremony, and, if so, which portions they might decide to use. When the tape ended, she started another. She was halfway through her mother's 1982 performance of the Elgar Cello Concerto, Opus 85, with the London Symphony Orchestra, when her phone rang. Elodie glanced at the time. It was late, and her first instinct was to worry that something had happened to her dad, but it was only Pippa. Elodie remembered the book launch at the publishing house in King's Cross. Her friend was probably on her way home now, wanting conversation on the walk. Her thumb hesitated above the answer button, but the call rang out. Elodie considered ringing back and then silenced the phone and tossed it onto the sofa. A peal of laughter carried up from the street below, and Elodie sighed. Some of the disquiet from her meeting with Pippa earlier that day lingered. Elodie had felt possessive about the photo of the Victorian woman in the white dress. But it had been more than that. Now, sitting in a room filled with the melancholy strains of her mother's cello lines, she knew that it was the way Pippa had asked about the recordings. They'd already talked about the subject back when Penelope had first suggested using clips of Lauren Adler at the wedding ceremony. Pippa had wondered then whether Elodie's dad might not have reservations, given that he could barely talk about Elodie's mother without welling up. Frankly, Elodie had held the same concerns, but it turned out he'd been quietly pleased, echoing Penelope's sentiment that it was the next best thing to having her there. Today, though, when Elodie had said as much, rather than dropping the subject and moving on, Pippa had pushed further, asking whether Elodie agreed. Now, watching Lauren Adler as she brought the Elgar to its aching conclusion, Elodie wondered whether perhaps Pippa had her own reasons. Within their friendship, Pippa had always occupied the more dynamic space, inviting attention where Elodie, naturally shy, preferred to play the support act. Maybe in this one instance, when Elodie could lay claim to an extraordinary parent, Pippa resented the intrusion. Even as the thought occurred to her, Elodie was ashamed of it. Pippa was a good friend who was even now busy designing and making Elodie's wedding dress. She had never done anything to suggest that she begrudged Elodie her parentage. In fact, she was one of the few people who'd never seemed particularly interested in Lauren Adler. Elodie was used to people, when they learned of the connection, tripping over themselves to ask questions, almost as if from Elodie they could absorb some of the talent and tragedy that had surrounded Lauren Adler. But not Pippa. Although over the years she'd asked plenty about Elodie's mother, whether Elodie missed her, whether she remembered much from before her mother died, her interest had been limited to Lauren Adler's maternal role. It was as if the music and fame, though interesting enough, were inconsequential in all the ways that mattered. The Elgar recording ended, and Elodie switched off the TV. Without Alistair there to insist on a proper weekend lie-in, she planned to get up early and take a long walk east along the river. She wanted to get to her great-uncle Tip before his shop opened. She showered and climbed into bed, closing her eyes and willing herself to sleep. The night was still warm and she was restless. Free-floating anxiety circled in the air above her like a mosquito looking to land a sting. Elodie turned and tossed and then turned again. She thought of Mrs. Berry and her husband, Thomas, and wondered if it was true that the love of one person, and such a tiny person as Mrs. Berry, 5 feet tall on a good day and as wiry as they come, was comfort enough to alleviate another